The reading today is from John chapter 20, verses 24 to 31, and that'll be on page 1089 of your church Bibles. Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus did many other miracles, miraculous signs, in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name.
Now we're going to start with a short clip from a song by the band 1975, and it's called "I Love It If We Make It." So here's a short clip. Sorry, you can't listen to more of it, but do go and listen to the rest of it later on. It's the song "I Love It If We Made It." And it's a song that the band described as a gem amongst all the rubble. The rubble they're speaking about, of course, is the world we find ourselves in. It's very striking, isn't it? In that music video, you have those terrible scenes of warfare, of buildings on fire. And yet running through that same song is this desire that we'll love it if we make it. That longing for hope. And the reason I start with that music video this evening is because I think that's where we find ourselves so often in the 21st century. We have that sort of vague sense of hope, or at least there should be hope. But then we look around us and there are plenty of reasons not to hope. Perhaps it is our world. We are very conscious of the climate warnings, and we think to ourselves, what hope can there be? Or we think about the warfare that takes place, even on our own continent, and we think, is there really hope? Or we look at the warfare that takes place on our social media platforms between one another, and we think, how do we stand a chance of living together? Or perhaps closer to home, we'd love to have hope ourselves, but then there are the daily struggles. Or we are very deeply conscious that one day our lives will end. What hope can there be? Or perhaps it comes down to how we feel. We love to feel more hopeful, but we just know that life doesn't give us happy endings. Perhaps we know that through bitter experience. Or perhaps we think for ourselves we don't deserve to hope, to have that sense of optimism. And so I think we're left with that feeling as human beings that we want to hope, we want to think that there are better days before us. But yet, we're facing the reality around us that there's every reason not to. And so we're just left, like the song, saying, well, we'll love it if we made it, but who knows if we will. But as we've been seeing in this book of John over these last couple of weeks, this is a book that contains a fantastic promise of hope. 2 weeks ago, you may remember we were in chapter 11, looking at Jesus raising his friend Lazarus from the dead. And you'll remember that Jesus said there, whoever believes in him has life beyond death. And last week, we saw Jesus meet the Samaritan woman, you'll remember. And Jesus said to her that he can offer her living water, life in all its fullness. And it is a message of hope running through this book. But the question is, are there any grounds for that hope? I mean, what makes what John is speaking about here any different to that song? That we're longing for some hope. The answer is Thomas. See, Thomas, in this passage this evening, he goes on a journey from unbelief to belief. And his journey, as we're going to see, is a journey that all people are encouraged to go on. And in his journey, he shows us what it is that gives us grounds for there being hope. We're going to see Thomas's unbelief. We're going to then see his belief. And then we're going to think about our response. See, first of all, then, that point about Jesus's unbelief. Because we pick up the action at the end of this gospel, this book of John, right at the end where Jesus has died and he's risen. And we're going to see this next week, but we're fast forwarding for the moment. But the thing is, Thomas has not been there when Jesus has appeared to Mary and his disciples. You'll see in verse 24 that he was not with the 12. And there might just be a hint there that something's amiss. See, John points out very deliberately that he is part of the 12. In other words, he should have been with these folk, but he wasn't. That's very interesting when you look at Thomas across this gospel. He pops up in chapter 11 where he's very zealous. He says he's going to go with Jesus and die with him. But in chapter 14, he seems more confused. He says to Jesus, "We don't know where you're going. How do we know the way?" And by chapter 20, it might well be that his hope has evaporated. Certainly seems that way, doesn't it? From his response, the disciples in verse 25 say, "Look, we've seen the Lord." But Thomas said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will never believe it." In the original, it's a really emphatic no. Never, ever believe it. I'm not believing it. And he puts up this ridiculous bar of evidence, putting his fingers in the marks of the hands and into Jesus' side. It's the sort of thing you say when you know that you're not going to be proven wrong. If someone said to me, "I've seen an alien," I would say, "Well, I'm not going to believe you unless I meet this Mr. Alien, unless I go in their spaceship, unless I eat Martian food." You know, it's the sort of thing I know is not going to happen. And Thomas knows full well that the dead do not rise. And so he puts this ridiculous bar of evidence to say that he will never, ever believe it. It's worth seeing, isn't it, that skepticism about Christianity is not a new thing. It's right there at the start. It's right there with one of Jesus' closest followers. See, Thomas may have loved to have hoped. He may have heard all the promises from Jesus about life, about relationship with God, but he knows full well that those promises evaporated with Jesus' last breath. But the thing is, Thomas is massively helpful because Thomas is where we so often find ourselves. Perhaps we're here this evening and we'd love to believe there's hope, but it just defies common sense. We speak about there being life after death, of God renewing this world, and we think to ourselves, how is that even possible? Or perhaps we just think to ourselves, that is not the way the world goes. We all know the story, don't we? That the powerful crush the weak. The big crush the small. And here's that story again. Jesus comes up against the Romans and he loses. Or perhaps we just feel, perhaps like Thomas did, well, yes, I'd love it if it happened, but I've got no reason to think that it will. See, Thomas comes in like I guess most of us would, looks at what's before him and says there is no hope. And yet we see in the second point that actually Thomas changes his mind massively, because there's one event that changes things and it comes in verse 26. We read there, verse 26, that a week later his disciples were in the house again. and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came in and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." So here are the disciples again. The front door yell lock is on, and Jesus appears before them. And, you know, it must have been quite embarrassing for Thomas, because he invites Thomas to do a live autopsy on his own body. It's pretty gruesome when you think about it. And just incidentally, the reason I think he does is to show us that this is a real body. See, a lot of people might think that Thomas was kind of hallucinating. Perhaps he had had a bit too much wine, or perhaps he was a bit tired, and he kind of may have seen this effect. But the thing about hallucinations is you can't touch them. You can't put fingers in their hands. And I'm told by the psychologists that actually hallucinations don't work on a group scale like this. That maybe one person have hallucination, not the 11 in the room. Or, as we read later in the New Testament, 500 people once saw Jesus at the same time. So here is Jesus, according to John, with a real body, resurrected like his previous body, but different. And for Thomas, that changes everything. Notice what he says in verse 28. Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Now, for a Jewish person like Thomas, to say something like that about a human being is unthinkable. Unless, that is, it's true. And John has made the case through this book that that is exactly the case. As unimaginable as it might be, as unthinkable as we might think of it, God has, in his Son, come into our world to bring hope. Here's how this book begins. Right in the very first line, it says this: "In the beginning was the Word." It's a kind of nickname for Jesus. "And the Word was with God, and the Word was God." See, right at the beginning, John says this person is no mere human being. He is your creator. And here is Thomas, right at the end, confessing that for himself: "My Lord and my God." But here's the key question. What is it that changes Thomas's mind? What takes him from that disbelief to belief? It's not that Thomas woke up one day and thought, "Do you know what? I'm in the mood for feeling a bit religious, and I'm going to kind of, you know, confess who Jesus was." It wasn't even that he kind of mustered up the faith and thought, "I'm going to believe this despite me thinking otherwise." What changed his mind? Well, he believed, didn't he, because of the evidence before him. He saw Jesus risen, and he trusted. See, there's, I think, a huge misunderstanding about that idea of faith. We talk about faith sometimes as believing despite all the evidence. But actually, Christian faith is believing because of the evidence. And that is exactly what Thomas does here. I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of the black swan. The black swan was a kind of mythical creature. We've got evidence of it being spoken about in the first century Roman era. And it was spoken about through the centuries, a bit like we speak about unicorns. I'm sorry if I've offended anyone, but unicorns are a mythical creature. Don't tell my daughter. But we talk about unicorns as a kind of mythical creature, and black swans were the same. They were used in literature as a sign of something impossible, like a flying pig, or, as I say, a unicorn. But then in the 1600s, Dutch sailors arrived on the west coast of Australia, and they were greeted with one of these. And I guess what that must have felt like to see one of these for the first time. It'd be like seeing a unicorn coming out of the woods or something like that. And from that point on, it no longer was a mythical creature. They had to talk about black swans as a reality. And it's similar here. As much as Thomas might have disbelieved, as much as Thomas may have thought it was impossible for Jesus to rise from the dead, Well, he's confronted with some evidence that says something very different. Going back to that song by the 1975, I don't know if you caught it, right at the beginning, there's that line, "Jesus save us, modernity has failed us." And that's not a kind of cry of Christian faith, it's a cry of desperation, like, we haven't got any other ideas, come on Jesus, save us. And the lead singer, Matt Healy, he spoke about that line, and here's what he said about it. He said, look, I want salvation just as much as the next person. I envy the faithful. If there's anyone out there who's got some good evidence on all this God stuff, give it to me, because now is the time. I will eat it up. And here is the answer. This is the evidence that we cry out for. It is the resurrection of Jesus. See, let's be honest. Something must have happened in the first century to take this group of frightened believers to become a global movement and change our world forever. Either it was a hoax of some sort, or either it really happened. And Thomas shows us that despite his reservations, it really did happen. And so that becomes the key question for you and me. If we're looking into Christian things, and I hope there'll be plenty here this evening who are looking into Christian things. We like that here at St. Mary's. We want to help with that. Perhaps we've got lots of questions, lots of things we're unsure about. But this is the key question. What do I make of the resurrection? Because if this is true, then everything that Jesus says is true. Or perhaps we come this evening a bit despairing. We feel like, where is hope going to come from? I'm not sure I can really look forward. But again, the question is, did the resurrection happen? Because if it did, all that Jesus promised is absolutely trustworthy. And I guess for us Christians who, you know, will have our moments of doubt, well, this is the key thing to come back to, isn't it? When I'm thinking, is it all true? Can I stake my life on this? Come back to that question. Is the resurrection true? Now, I guess some of us will be thinking to ourselves, that's all very well for Thomas. He saw Jesus. But what about us? Because after all, we haven't got a time machine and we can't go back and see what he saw. But as we see in our third and final point, that actually the fact that we're not there to see it is not a barrier to belief. And we see that in Jesus' response. How Jesus responds here is very interesting, because you might expect Jesus to say, well, well done, Thomas, you've come to the right conclusion. But what does he say? Well, look at verse 29. Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. There's a kind of edge to this, isn't there? There's a sense of rebuke. He's saying to Thomas, look, you believe me because you saw me? Well, it would have been better to believe having not seen me. Jesus doesn't mean, of course, that we're into the business of blind faith, because, of course, he's showing the evidence to his disciples. But he is saying to Thomas, look, you should have believed because of their testimony. See, the moment the disciples came in and said, we have seen the Lord, that should have been enough for Thomas to believe. A few weeks ago, one of my friends texted me and said that he'd seen Lenny Henry in a hotel one evening. And he told me about the conversation they had. He pointed out the fact that Lenny Henry wasn't in a Premier Inn, and I can't really repeat what Lenny Henry said back. But, you know, when my friend told me this, I texted back and said, well, that's amazing. You're so cool and everything. I didn't text back and think, well, you're a liar. I didn't even text back and say, well, until I meet Lenny Henry and ask him whether you really had that conversation about the Premier Inn, I'm not going to believe it. That would have been pretty offensive. I know my friend. I know he doesn't make up stories about meeting celebrities. I know he's trustworthy. And so when he tells me something that isn't every day like that, well, I have no reason to doubt it. And it's similar here. See, when the disciples come in and say, we've seen the Lord, Thomas knew them. He knew what they were like. He knows what Jesus is like. He should have believed. And what is true for Thomas is also true for you and me this evening. See, look at what John goes on to say in verse 30. He says, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. See, John has said, look, I've done some editing work here. I've only picked 21 chapters. But these 21 chapters are sufficient for you to believe and have the life that Jesus promises. See, we don't have to wait to see Jesus like Thomas. In this book, we have everything necessary to come to believe in him. How do we find hope? Well, the question becomes, will we trust what we're told here? Perhaps we're new to Christian things this evening, and perhaps this is the first time we've thought about these things. Well, it may be for us that we want to spend time reading this, wrestling through what this book claims, and we want to encourage that. Please do come and chat to me afterwards. I'd love to give you a copy of the Bible to have a look at that. We've got a course running next term called Christianity Explored, which helps us look at one of these gospel accounts for ourselves and decide what we think. Perhaps we're here this evening, and this is not the first time, and we've thought about these things for a while, but we've still got lots of questions. But the key question is, will I trust what I'm told here? Will I trust the eyewitnesses? And for those of us who do believe already and are confident, will I read this? Will I know it? Will I let this give me the hope that Jesus promises? As we finish, according to church tradition, Thomas, from this point on, went on in his belief, and he went out to India, which in those days was really a one-way trip, and it certainly was for Thomas. And if it was true, it is just a very typical illustration of what happened to all these disciples. See, Thomas went from complete unbelief to denying it could even be possible to embracing Jesus and resting his whole life on this truth of the resurrection. And it's something that a few years ago I came to the belief that it's true. And because of that, we can have hope. See, if Jesus did really rise, we don't have to stay in our apathy. We don't have to, like the 1975, say, we'd love it if we made it. But we can know we will make it. We can know that all that Jesus promises is true. We can have hope. Not in the vague sense that we might make it, but knowing that Jesus himself has made it.
Now, chance to get to those questions. We have three, which is just about perfect given the time we have. So, quick one to start with. Can you recommend any recent books that make the case for the resurrection?
I can recommend 66 books. joking aside, I think sometimes we look for books outside this book to make a case. This book was compiled with the view that actually these books, so it's made up of 66 books, with the view that actually this makes the case for the resurrection. So John, as he says, is writing so that we would believe Jesus is the Christ. And by that he means everything that's included in that title, so that actually as we read John, that should be enough to convince us. But of course, there are other Gospels, there's Mark, Matthew and John, what's the other one? Luke. Thank you. Which make the case as well. So let me encourage you, you know, this hopefully is written in a pretty accessible thing. We may not understand everything, but someone said to me when I was at university, why don't you read Luke's gospel? And I did, and that was how I became convinced of this. And let me encourage you to do that as well. There are lots of books out there speaking about this. There's a book that a lot of people like. I haven't read it all the way through, so I'm half recommending it. It was good what I read. Lee Strobel, Case for Christ, who was a kind of skeptic about these things, looked into them. I think he was a lawyer or a journalist or something like that. And so, yeah, that's quite a helpful example of someone looking into the evidence as well. But yeah, Bible, then there are some other bits as well.
Great, that's really helpful. Okay, so next one. So reflecting on sharing the truth, which I guess is kind of linking with what Sam said earlier, how do we best do that in a world rapidly running to their own facts and selective interpretation?
Thank you. I guess I was hoping to model that a little bit with that song, the 1975, because even though we may run to doing life on our own terms, I think there is that kind of, someone talks about it as a kind of sense of being haunted by what we truly are and by God truly existing. So no one's kind of in a vacuum where God's influence isn't there. We all have those sense that actually something should be different. And you see that in that song, don't you? The band leader said that actually he wrote it because he was just so angry with stuff that was happening. But yet there's that sense of hope. And I guess that, for me, speaks to our humanness. It speaks to the fact that we are made for something bigger than this world. And I guess that is what we want to tap into. So, yeah, I think asking people why it is they hope. I remember having a conversation with a non-Christian friend of mine who said, I think we're going to mess the whole world up and I think we're all going to die, but I've got to believe that we won't. And I was like, that doesn't sound very, you know, it doesn't sound very optimistic, but they're the sort of conversations I think you can have with people. And I think coming back to this and showing that actually that sense of hope gets explained because actually it comes from somewhere real and believable, and that's here. That would be my first stab.
No, I think that's really helpful because you've got kind of both sides. Actually, you know, if someone wants to look into the evidence, that actually there is evidence there.
Yes.
But if someone is, you know, maybe less likely to be convinced by that, actually, it's just such a good thing
that we
can share, and it's just, you know, so appealing what there is to share.
Yeah. My sense is, I may be completely wrong on this. My sense is, a lot of people have rejected Christianity not because they've looked at the evidence and thought it through, just because they've heard something about Christianity and think, yeah, I don't want any of that. Mm. Pretty much every conversation I have with someone who's not a Christian, I have to say, if that's your vision of God, well, I disagree with that God as well. Let me tell you about what actually I believe from this book, and that's often quite different.
Yeah, that's helpful. Great. So last question, what does life in his name look like? Do we all need to become vicars?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Come. Sign up at the door. Some of us might, and love to have a conversation about that. What does life look like in his name? Well, how long have you got? It looks like many different things, and I think part of the beauty of the New Testament is that you see lots of people in lots of different contexts responded to this truth in lots of different ways. So for Thomas, it meant going to India. For Sam, we heard earlier, it meant being a Christian in refuge and waste, even though the job might be quite rubbish. Sorry, that's awful. I'm thinking of other waste-related puns now. it looks different. It looked different for Aaron. You know, it looked different for the Samaritan woman we saw last week and for Lazarus. So for some of us, it may mean doing a full-time teaching job like this. And for some of us who have got that sort of ability, I'd encourage you to think about that. But for the vast majority of us, it will mean actually working this out in the context that God's placed me. I think that's just an excellent question to ask yourself. Does my life look different because the resurrection's true? Mm. And if not, why not? And if the resurrection is true, what should it look like differently?